Good afternoon. This is Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review, and it's Wednesday, November 13th. Let's start with the front page. From Valerie Wells in Decatur and the Decatur School Board. Two current members seeking re-election. Pair of newcomers show interest as filing period begins. Decatur School Board Vice President Jason Dion was one of only a handful of area school board candidates in line bright and early on Tuesday, the first day for filing petitions to run for school board seats. I'm excited about the work that the school district is currently doing to set a new strategic direction, Dion said outside the Macon County Clerk's office. I know it will be hard work and will require the perspective of all our stakeholders. I believe with this work, we will be able to provide Decatur families and our town the future it deserves. I look forward to being a part of that work as a member of the Board of Education and will be running for re-election next year. The election will be on April 1st, and the Decatur School Board has 4 seats open for election. In addition to Dion, incumbent board member Alana Banks said she planned to file for re-election later in the week. Board members Al Scheider and Kevin Collins have decided against running for re-election. With only 2 incumbents choosing to run, the Decatur board will have at least 2 new faces. Karen Lauritsen was among those in line Tuesday morning to be one of those new faces. I feel that the Decatur School Board can do a lot to improve DPS schools for kids, she said. Johns Hill Magnet School teacher Kevin Hale also plans to run for the Decatur School Board, and said Tuesday morning that he planned to file his paperwork after school on Tuesday afternoon. Hale will retire from teaching at the end of the school year. Banks said on Monday that she is still committed to the work of the board. Over the past term, I've focused on creating an inclusive, equitable environment that supports all students, especially those from marginalized backgrounds, Banks said. From helping select visionary leadership to advocating for our students' unique needs, I've seen firsthand how positive change is possible when we work together. I'm running again because I believe there's more we can achieve. I want to continue strengthening our schools, expanding resources, and ensuring every student has the support they deserve to thrive. This work is my passion, and I'm excited about what we can accomplish with another term. Regarding their decisions not to run for re-election, Scheider and Collins cited challenges brought about by new jobs. Scheider began working as a counselor for Bloomington High School in August and said he doesn't have the time to be equally committed to both roles. Collins also has taken a job in another community, though he still resides in Decatur, and the long hours plus commuting leaves him with less time for the board. The extra demands of all the added special meetings, coupled with the fact the district always seems to be reacting to another crisis and not moving forward, has left me without enough time to commit to the position as originally desired, Collins said. I vowed to finish at least one term and owe it to those who voted for me to complete my term, which I will do. The constant lack of communication and interferences we all need to vote the same is another reason I have chosen not to run for a second term. Dion and Lauritsen weren't alone in line Tuesday morning. They were joined by 3 incumbents from other schools in the county seeking to be reelected. Michelle Shoemaker for Mount Zion School Board, Josh Hilbert for Sangamon Valley School Board, and Victoria Williams for Warrensburg-Latham Board. In addition to school boards, voters in April also will select members to local city councils, village boards, park district boards, community college boards, township boards, library boards, and fire protection district boards, among others. The filing period for a majority of these offices concludes Monday, November 18th. Filing continues daily through Monday, November 18th. We have a photo on the front page of the Copper Dome on the century-old Logan County Courthouse in Lincoln, which was leaking. In 2020, a tax referendum allowed the county to start raising money to replace it, and the new dome was installed in 2024. Logan County crowning glory. Lincoln Courthouse has a new copper dome and HVAC system. From D. Jack Alkier in Lincoln. After years of planning, fighting for a tax referendum, and enduring the disruptions of a global pandemic, The Logan County Courthouse finally has a shiny new copper headpiece. The copper outer dome itself was completed in the spring, but restoration of the century-old courthouse continues to modernize the building. "They don't build buildings like this anymore," said Jim Westbecker, building and grounds chair on the Logan County Board. "It'd be a shame to tear it down." Besides the copper dome, the HVAC system has been updated from a boiler system to geothermal heating and cooling. The windows and concrete facade are being replaced, and safety upgrades are being made to the security desk in all three courtrooms, said project manager Bill Walter of Ohio-based Masonry Restoration Technologies and Services, LLC. The work is meant to keep the courthouse operating, serviceable, and beautiful for at least another half century, Walter said. That means the skyline of Lincoln will remain historic and iconic for residents like Westbecker to enjoy. It's hard to imagine if this wasn't in the middle of downtown, he said. According to Walter, the copper for the dome and the labor to install it cost around $2 million, but the problem was getting the materials. The project started in 2020, just before the COVID-19 pandemic shut down pretty much everything, he said. We were relying on getting a lot of the copper from Canada, and commerce was shut down for a little over 18 months, he said. That stalled the project, but they were able to keep the cost as expected by waiting, Walter said. The pandemic also completely derailed any projected budget or completion timeline, he said. We had a completion date, and then we had the pandemic, Walter said. We have no completion date now. What we're doing is paying more attention to how efficient we can do each entity of the project, and it's going to happen in its own time frame. Walter cautiously estimated that they will finish all work next summer with a final cost of $11 million, possibly up to $12 million. Modernizing and keeping the building as a courthouse, as opposed to raising it or turning it into something like a museum, is the most cost-effective option, Westbecker said. Cost alone, to tear it down, you're probably talking $5 million, and then the cost of building a generic building, you'd have to build another one somewhere off-site for court systems and county officials, he said. The board believes this project is the most fiscally responsible use of taxpayer dollars, Westbecker said. Funds for the restoration project come from a tax referendum that went into effect 4 years ago, Westbecker said. The Logan County Public Sales Tax Referendum, voted on in 2019, has a 20-year lifespan and is a half-cent increase on retail and restaurant sales, he said. The revenue from this is approximately $100,000 a month, he added. Besides the restoration project, that money will also feed a rainy day fund for courthouse repairs in the future, he said. But the board does not plan on keeping the tax for the whole 20 years, as the project will not take that long to fund, he said. Even though it's 20 years, the hope is sometime we can cut it off, Westbecker said. That rainy day fund will help the county maintain the courthouse in the future so that a major project like this is less likely to be needed, he added. From a cost standpoint, the HVAC system is the big ticket item, Walter said, coming in at around $6.5 million. The boiler heaters were in desperate need of repair, he said. The courthouse itself was limping along with a couple of antique boilers, which when they were in the mood, they operated fine, Walter said. When they weren't, they didn't. A cooling system was practically non-existent, he added. They had some window units, so whenever the window AC units could keep up with the climate, people in the courthouse, were comfortable, Walter said. The restoration project included an entirely new geothermal installation, he said, with 39 wells around the courthouse drilled 400 feet deep and filled with pipes that feed into the building's basement where the boilers used to sit. A special fluid that will not freeze travels through those deep pipes and reaches a temperature of around 55 degrees, Walter said. And then that 55-degree fluid comes up into the system here, and then we heat it from 55 to 70, or we heat it to 65 if we want it to cool, he said. This method is superior to boiler heating because it is less taxing on the heating system itself, since it requires less energy, he said. Your ability to modulate the temperature in a short parameter, plus or minus 20 degrees, is much easier on equipment than trying to modulate it over a parameter of 50 degrees, Walter said. Even though the initial bill was high, geothermal is more cost-effective and efficient in the long run, he said. After it was installed, it was the cheapest option and produced the best results, Walter said. While the dome and the HVAC were two of the most major upgrades, security updates to the three courtrooms and the security office are also necessary and ongoing, Walter said. The judge's bench, the jury boxes, and witness stands need to be replaced with bulletproof materials, Walter said, and the checkpoint and recording equipment need to be upgraded per state law. They want to keep the judge and jury safe. They want to keep the prisoners safe. They want to keep the occupants of the courthouse and general public that comes in and out safe, he said. These upgrades are not about comfort or want, Walter said, but are required. It's not luxury. It's not. Boy, wouldn't it be nice to have this, he said. It's a necessity. The final project will be replacing the surface of the tile floor in the hallways, Walter said. A century of walking and washing and an abundance of humidity has warped the mortar beneath the tiles in the courthouse, he said. And while the tiles need to be replaced, that does not mean the floor is unsafe. The floor itself, structurally, absolutely not a problem, Walter said. And we have a photo of Mike Marion with CAD Construction and Design Works in the circuit court room at the Logan County Courthouse on October 9th. Three of the building's courthouses are undergoing renovations to improve safety for the judge's bench, jury boxes, and witness stands. And our last article from the front page, Illinois Government, from Jeremy Gorner and Olivia Olander in the Chicago Tribune. Trump's second term looms over Dems in fall session. Democrats who control the Illinois General Assembly returned to Springfield this week, facing an agenda that now includes considering how to address the implications of President-elect Donald Trump's return to power. Lawmakers will be looking into whether any of the state's left-leaning laws in areas including reproductive rights and immigration need to be shored up because of fears the incoming Trump administration might take action to undo the state's policies. We're gathering a list of things that we may need to address, maybe not during veto session, but maybe. It can be done in the new year, Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker said last week. But suffice to say that we have a lot of work that we're looking at doing. While Democrats held on to their supermajorities in both legislative chambers in last week's election, Trump's showing in the deeply blue state was surprisingly strong. The former president lost the state by only about 9 percentage points after falling short by 17 points in each of the previous two elections. House Republican leader Tony McCombie of Savannah said those numbers should give Democrats pause about responding to Trump with new laws. I don't know any legislation that would be necessary as a reaction, McCombie said. I think the Democrats have to be careful. The fall veto session, which started Tuesday, includes only six scheduled days, three this week and three next week. Since Pritzker didn't veto any bills this year, lawmakers face no essential business. House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch said last week that the session will be an opportunity to continue discussions on certain proposals, but that larger issues would need more time to get settled. As for the effect Trump's administration may have in coming years, the Hillside Democrat acknowledged Illinois has made good strides in recent years with certain laws it has put on the books. But he said more could be done during the January lame duck session, held before a new legislature is sworn in. We could call a lame duck session and do some things when it comes to workers' rights, women's rights, LGBTQ+ rights. We have an opportunity that we can do some things before Donald Trump takes the oath of office, Welch said. We're going to be a check on Donald Trump. As a state, we have rights. And we did it in his first term, and we'll do it again. Aside from possibly addressing how to adapt to a Trump presidency, Pritzker has said he doesn't have a significant legislative agenda for the year's final session and agreed with Welch that bigger issues will be addressed next year. In addition, a report released earlier this month from Pritzker's budget office said the state faces a deficit of about $3.2 billion in the fiscal year beginning July 1st. If that estimate holds true in the next couple of months, the governor has some difficult decisions ahead, including whether to initiate spending cuts or propose more tax increases. McCombie warned it's going to be a very scary time for the governor and Democrats given the deficit, but Pritzker last week downplayed the forecast and said the budget he proposes in February will be balanced. We know that the bills that we pass in Springfield have real life and death consequences. It is clear that we must address child access to firearms and safe storage. Representative Mara Hirschhauer, a Democrat from Batavia, said at a news conference on Chicago's West Side in October, "We know that gun owners can help make their homes and communities safe by storing their guns securely. A comprehensive statewide safe storage policy will have an impact on this." Illinois lawmakers could also take up a proposal to create a statewide office to help under-resourced public defenders. One of the proposal's goals is to address the lack of public defense resources in rural areas, many of which don't even have a public defender's office, as well as disparities in the resources allotted to county prosecutors and public defenders. For example, Cook County's 2024 budget provided about $102 million for its public defender's office and about $205 million for its state's attorney's office. Representative Dave Vella, a Rockford Democrat who's behind the measure, said the bill could come up for discussion during January's lame duck session. "We've been working on getting language straight and kind of letting people know about what's going on," Vella said in October. "The longer we push this off, the longer there are people who are in the system that we think needs to be changed." During the veto session, State Senator Rachel Ventura said she wants to continue pushing for legislation that would approve the use of psilocybin, an ingredient found in certain types of mushrooms that can have psychedelic effects as a treatment for conditions like anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder. The bill has yet to make it out of the Senate and would also need to pass through the House before heading to the governor's desk. Ventura also wants to push a bill that would mandate more transparency from the Illinois Prisoner Review Board on its adherence to the state's Joe Coleman Medical Release Act, which makes people in prison eligible for early release for medical reasons. The legislation, which passed in the House in April but has languished in the Senate, calls for, among other things, the medical release hearings to be public unless the person incarcerated requests otherwise. If the review board denies medical release, it must publish details of its decision. There were some issues with some of those cases, and we're hoping to create some more transparency with that process, said Ventura, a Democrat from Joliet, who is the Senate sponsor of the bill. Representative LaShawn Ford said he was close to an agreement that would allow all dispensaries to sell medical cannabis, a proposal that failed during the spring legislative session. Separately, he said he was reevaluating legislation for an overdose prevention site on Chicago's West Side, which would allow people to use drugs in a supervised environment. Last week, Ford said the bill should instead be passed as a task force that could make recommendations for such a site. That bill recently received its first Republican co-sponsor in Representative Steve Reich of Woodstock. Another bill that could get discussed by the lame duck session is a measure allowing people in Illinois who die to have their human remains converted into soil, a process called natural organic reduction or human composting. It's seen by advocates as a more eco-friendly method of handling human remains. The bill has passed in the Senate, in the House, and is currently in the Senate. A proposal to legalize medical aid in dying, often referred to as physician-assisted suicide, or medically assisted death, that would give mentally competent, terminally ill adults the right to choose to end their lives is also on the table. It would allow these patients the right to access life-ending prescription medication, which they could then self-administer at a time of their choosing. Chicago Tribune's Dan Petrella contributed to this story. Now from page A3, local and state news. From the Chicago Tribune, Rick Pearson. Durbin, weighing re-election. We'll see how GOP shift affects Senate. As U.S. Senator Dick Durbin evaluates his political future, last week's election giving Republicans a Senate majority is now part of the calculus for the chamber's number two ranking Democrat. Durbin, a Democrat from Springfield who turns 80 November 21st, has yet to say if he'll run for re-election in 26. He has been in the Senate since 1997 after serving 14 years in the House. After the November 5th election, Republicans will hold at least 53 Senate seats, with one race in Arizona yet to be decided, though Democrat Ruben Gallego was leading Republican Kerry Lake by nearly 70,000 votes, with 92% of the expected ballots counted. The GOP victories undid a 50-50 tie in the Senate that gave Democrats control of the chamber because Vice President Kamala Harris was a tiebreaker as Senate president. "I'm going to watch and see what this means," Durbin said Monday. "I enjoy serving in the Senate. I'm a realist about the future, but I want to see how the relationship works." Durbin noted that he was able to engineer what he called the most significant sentencing reform bill in modern history during Donald Trump's first administration, working with Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley. The First Step Act reduced mandatory minimum federal prison sentences for some nonviolent drug offenses and created programs to reduce recidivism, so things can be done if you're doing it the right way, he said. Durbin is expected to announce his future intentions in the new year. Should he decide not to seek re-election, a host of Democrats would be expected to seek the seat, and it also could open the door for several Republican contenders. Though Illinois has not elected a GOP senator since Mark Kirk won in his single term in 2010. The Democrats' loss of power in the chamber will strip Durbin of his chairmanship of the powerful Senate Judiciary Committee, a position from which he led nomination hearings for Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Asked if he would serve as the ranking minority member on the judiciary panel, Durbin said, "It remains to be seen who will take over as chair." "I hope it's Lindsey Graham," he said of the South Carolina senator, who currently leads the minority on the panel. "But I can live with Chuck Grassley if he's chosen." "What I tried to do when I was chairman for 4 years at Judiciary was to establish some bipartisan standards," Durbin said, "such as retaining the blue slip process that allows the home state senator of a judicial candidate to block a nomination. It was being challenged by my own party. I can go chapter and verse and tell you people who are madder than hell at me because I said I'm going to respect the blue slip because Lindsey Graham told me he'll respect it if he's chairman," Durbin said. "So it remains to be seen how that works." Durbin said the process enabled him to fill every vacancy on the federal bench in Illinois during Trump's first term. "During the Trump administration, we filled every vacancy in Illinois, every judgeship I had to sit down and bargain with the chief counsel for President Trump, which wasn't always easy," he said. "He got some people I didn't like. I got some people he didn't like," Durbin said. In the latter group was Mary Rowland, who in 2019 became the first openly lesbian judge to serve in the Chicago area's Northern District. "So far as staying on the Judiciary Committee," Durbin said, "the short answer is, it depends on what the Trump administration is going to do when it comes to judges, and it depends on who will chair the Senate Judiciary Committee." Durbin lamented that passing major legislation, like the Prison Sentencing Reform Act measure, is now increasingly rare in the Senate amid a pattern of more limited action. "That's the nature of the Senate now. I mean, it used to be we had a handful of big bills moving every year. Not so anymore. Not so on a regular schedule," he said, also noting changes that limit floor amendments to legislation. "It just isn't the Senate anymore. It isn't the way it works." Durbin also said he and his staff are researching major transportation funding-related items for Illinois to make sure the money will flow despite a Trump presidency. "We've got to make sure we've nailed down the projects," he said. And now the agribusiness column from Stu Ellis. Farm legislation is highly political. Federal legislation, commonly known as the Farm Bill, guides production plans and income receipts of nearly all 2 million U.S. farmers in the United States. The five-year legislation that was signed into law in 2018 and its one-year extension expired in September. A politically belligerent Congress has been unable to get anything passed that would replace the complexities in the legislation. Republicans want cuts to food programs for the indigent, and Democrats want increased funding for conservation. The can was kicked into the current calendar year without any movement. Most recently, it was kicked into the lame duck session of Congress, where the farm bill is too complex to be easily approved. In the meantime, a Mississippi congressman has created a temporary one-year proposal of sorts to appease farmers with legislation only with financial supports designed to offset low commodity prices and high production costs for 8 major crops, including corn and soybeans. In line with the traditional high supports for cotton, rice, and peanuts, His Farm Act legislation is quite generous in its financial outlays for farmers. Unsurprisingly, most farm organizations have endorsed the legislation, primarily because there is nothing else on the table that seems to be getting traction and has the chance of becoming law. The Farm Act does not contain the typical restrictions that prevent everyone in large families collecting big checks from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It is much less generous to corn, soybeans, and wheat growers than producers of southern crops. One organization which is not in the mainstream of agriculture, Farm Action, has raised concerns about the proposal, saying Big Ag wants the legislation. By increasing subsidy payments for the 2024 crop year to $350,000 for those farmers who make over 75% of their income from farming, the legislation would provide billions of dollars to the largest farm operations across the U.S. Farm Action says, "We will oppose this bill and any other attempt to circumvent the farm bill process to fund those who need it the least." Quite disconnected from Farm Action are the ag economists at the University of Illinois group, known as Farm Doc. In a daily treatise last week, the Farm Doc ag economists provided the financial details not cited by Farm Action, which indicated the plans of Republican U.S. Representative Trent Kelly would not have much chance in getting passed in Congress. FarmDoc said the sheer size of the proposed support payments presents significant hurdles to the Farm Act becoming law as proposed. The estimated 2024 cost of $21 billion is more than the entire 10-year baseline for farm support programs that are expiring. Moreover, the $350,000 payment limit that can be doubled for us with a spouse or multiplied for every partner in a general partnership could also present significant political barriers. The Illinois farm policy specialists on the FarmDoc team looked at the plan with a jaundiced eye, adding, "Its consideration in a lame duck session likely precludes reauthorization of the farm bill, kicking it into a new year and a new Congress." And now from local briefs, hooray for the holiday sale set Thursday at St. Mary's. A variety of unique items will be for sale Thursday, November 14th at the Hooray for the Holidays Christmas sale, sponsored by the partners of HSHS St. Mary's Hospital. The sale will be held from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. Thursday, November 14th in the hospital's Assisi Room. This year's event features several raffles, including a vintage crocheted Afghan, money tree and winter arrangement, as well as Santa's Closet, a collection of gently used Christmas items, a bake sale, and handcrafted items from the partner's artisans. Cash, credit, and debit cards are accepted. All proceeds and donations will go toward the hospital's greatest needs. In Warrensburg, Warrensburg-Latham Lions Club hosting a soup supper. The Warrensburg-Latham Lions Club is hosting its first soup supper on Saturday, November 16th. It will be held from 4:30 to 7 p.m. at the Warrensburg Methodist Church, 195 North Main Street, Warrensburg. The menu will include chili, vegetable soup, hot dogs, desserts, and drinks. Tickets are $10 for adults and children over 12 years of age. Tickets for children ages 3 to 12 are $5, and children under 3 are free. Proceeds will go to help meet the needs of the community. Warrensburg-Latham Lions Club is the sole service club organization representing the Warrensburg-Latham School District. Hospital service to bring attention to organ donation. HSHS St. Mary's Hospital will host a service in honor of National Donor Sabbath at 10:30 a.m. Friday, November 15th in the hospital's main lobby. The service honors those who have donated or received organs, those still waiting on the transplant list, as well as those who have passed. The service will include a blessing, candle lighting, and prayers. The featured speaker will be local organ donation advocate Sarah Butts. Other guests will include representatives of Decatur Memorial Hospital, Gift of Hope, Impact Life, and Life Goes On, and the Illinois Secretary of State Organ Tissue Donor Program. Information on organ, eye, and tissue donation can be found at giftofhope.org or lifegoeson.com. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, November 13th. Please stay tuned.